accession number 20588, reel 6.
This is Walter Cuss, reel 6. Okay, so you're coming to Dusseldorf.
Anyway, we're, first of all, before actually getting to Dusseldorf, in a place called Duisburg. And we built a small bridge over the River Ruhr, folding boat bridge.
Can I just ask you here, now we'd like to know some actual details of how the work was divided up and how they had organised you to build these bridges so quickly. Can you remember the exactly
well,
how many there were in perhaps working on the bridge and how you were divided up into different
parts? When you're building a bridge, you've got what you call an unloading party and a construction party. One party unloading, one party building the bridge. You've got a rear bridge park. Now, when you're doing a bridge, you've got a radio communication with a rear, with the bridge train, which is Royal Army Service Corps. Now, you contact them, and they move bridging as you require it to a rear bridge park. Right? That stuff stops there. Now, only so much moves forward at a time. Then the forward rear building, forward bridge park moves. Viruses up to the rear bridge park, send certain things through, might be 10 Bailey panels or something like that. And then you've got an unloading party. They unload the bridging. Then you've got a construction party, and they actually build the bridge. And that's how it's done. All done by radio communication. You've got a signals unit attached to you, see, Royal Signals. And you've got a what you call a rear link, which is a wireless link with your brigade headquarters. You see?
So you'd be constantly in touch with
the
brigade.
You're in constant touch all the time. Everything's done on a radio, like.
Yeah.
I mean, say, when I went in there first, it was flags. There was no such thing as radios. That's back in 1940. We never had any sets, 18 sets or number 9 sets or anything like that. You had a signals unit attached to you. You also had a RAF bomb disposal unit attached to you to defuse any British bombs which haven't gone off. And that's how the bridge is done.
So what would be the procedure then? In you've got all your parts, which you call up as you want them, basically. Do you?
Well, they build. We're all trained to know what we've got to do next, you see, so everybody does their job next.
Right. So what are the different jobs?
Well, you've got what you call bank seats. Built first of all, bank seats. In the case of a folding boat bridge, you've got to make a track. If it's across a field, you put down what you call summer field track. It's like stuff you build airfields for. And you lay that and you form a road on it. So if a vehicle's got to cross a field, or if it can't cross, the road is blown up, you've got to make another road. And that goes to the bridge area where you're building. And you bridge a bridge like that. Then you put your bank seats in. Now, it's not just a haphazard affair. It's all got to be levelled in. Now, with a Bailey bridge, you build the bank seats in the bank. They all got to be cut out, necessary, with a compressor. You've got spades to cut the banks out. You need, if necessary, you'll concrete them. And then you've got the bank seats put in. Then you've got your roller chassis. Now, the method of launching a Bailey bridge is a point of balance. You start the bridge off on the rollers, and you push it forward on rollers. Now, all these have been levelled in with theodolite. You push the bridge forward to the point of balance. Now, before you build a bridge, you put a nose on it like that. It goes up in the air, which is a counterbalance. You push the bridge forward to reach the counterbalance, and you stop. And you put some more panels on it to counterbalance the weight you got on the front. And that goes right across the river like that. And when you get the other side, a party goes over and takes that nose thing off. Then the bridge is jacked down on jacks onto the rollers and secured. And that's how it's done. All counterbalance work.
And how many different groups of you you'd have actually doing that work, or would you be working as one team? How many of you?
You'd be about. It's all according to the size of the bridge, you see. It's all according to the size of the bridge. I mean, you have as many about 30 men on a small one. You could use a whole company. Well, a company split up, got half loading, half building. That sort of thing.
Right. And who would be supervising and giving the orders there?
Well, the officers in charge, or whoever's doing the bridge, whoever's in charge of it. Mm-hmm. If it's a massive great bridge, you'd use another company with you as well. You'd use half a field company or a full field company altogether. Mm-hmm. It's all according to what equipment's got to be done, and its pace it's got to be done.
Yeah. So you got pretty good at it by the time
you got
worked
first class
for
at
Germany.
It. First class at it, no doubt about it. first class at it. You could do it in any condition of weather, night or day. And used to get a rum ration as well. The CO made sure you had a rum ration. He was a good officer, a damn good officer. Mm. He's dead now, of course. But
what was the sort of status of engineers in the army?
I think he was a civil engineer in civil state. He became a lieutenant colonel. Mm.
What was your status as engineers? Were you respected in the army?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Mm. Couldn't have done without us. Mm. I mean, if you didn't have engineers, how are you going to cross the rivers? Or defuse mines or do that sort of thing? It's a highly specialised job.
Mm. Right. So, after your motoring accident, and you didn't get your leave, what sort of... You went up to hospital in... Sorry, it was in...
I was in hospital. I was in hospital in Brussels first of all. Field General Hospital.
Right. What was that like? Tell me about that experience. Was it in a building or in a tent or?
What was convent? From the convent, nuns looked after us.
Oh right.
Oh, they did look. But of course, you had the Queen's Alexandra Royal Nursing Service, like, but nuns looked after us. But you had to look after the chaps. You see, if you were mobile, you had to go and get what they wanted. Got a big nappy in there, you go up there and get things like that. Now then, after that, I went to a rehabilitation centre, I don't want a better word, and I met a sergeant in there in the Durham Light Infantry. It was a Canadian field hospital. So we went in there now.
And what were they doing with you there? I mean, they were rehabilitating you, but how?
Well, you weren't doing much at all, really. You had your bed and so forth and all that sort of business. And you were sort of resting yourself up, more or less. And it was a Canadian hospital, rehabilitation centre. I was in there during VE day. And I was charged with getting all the beer for the men to drink, buckets and buckets of it. They had big vats of beer. Where they got it from, I don't know, but they had it. So this sergeant Darren Light, and we were in hospital blues, you see. So we had our uniforms in there, under the bed. So I got friendly with one of the nurses in there. She was a second lieutenant, I think. She was lieutenant, she was. So I got round her and I said, going out for a drink. Well, you can't go out for a drink in their clothes. I said, well, what about the uniform? I said, oh, you use your uniform, put our uniforms on. Now, the matron is out somewhere, I don't know where she was. Anyhow, we go out now to have a drink. And we're coming back at midnight, and we come up. This nurse told me to come up the fire escape, so we're coming up the fire escape, and who should be stuck at the top was the matron. Of course, all hell was let loose then. She's threatened to get him stripped, and all of this. He's going to get me this, that, and all of that. Anyhow, it all blew over. Now, the following day, the lieutenant comes up to me, the nursing lieutenant. She said, I used to wear their cloaks. You see a blue cloak with a red lining. And she had all these divisional signs on it, but she didn't have mine. So she wanted me to cut a divisional sign off my uniform for her to stick on her tunic. I said, no way you're going to have that, I said. Can't do that, I said. There's only one either side. So she didn't get that. So then I left there and went to Connachan in Belgium. So we're back to where I was talking to before. Went to Connachan in Belgium, was on telephones there, and I said, we got posted. We're sort of going back a bit here, aren't we? Mm-hmm. Anyhow, let's get back up now to where we got to in Dewsbury.
So you were going to get sent back
this
to
bridge,
your unit, yeah?
Building this bridge in Dewsbury, over the river Roar. We've done this bridge, now then, we moved to a little village called Heiligen House, which is about 4 miles outside of Dusseldorf. And what we were doing there was going out every day surveying bridges, testing them for strength, and dismantling Bailey bridges on the Autobahn and all the rest of it. And we used to have, at night, we used to go into Dusseldorf. We used to, have a truck to take us into Dusseldorf. And there was plenty of entertainment in Dusseldorf, army entertainment, hence the concerts and all the rest of it. And a big naffy there and so forth.
Who did you see in the concerts there?
Nellie Dean. Nellie Wallace, quite a few of them. George Formby. I'm not sure where it was. Gracie Fields. I'm not sure. But quite a few artists that were around at the time, like, you know.
What state was Dusseldorf in?
Well, surprisingly good, as a matter of fact. Surprisingly good. Dusseldorf, in some places, was pretty bad. Now, we were clearing a lot of rubbish and buildings from there, and I contracted tonsillitis. And I was taken to hospital. And I was in a ward with an American sergeant, and he woke me up in the middle of the night, and my pillow was covered with blood. Apparently the tonsils are burst or something like that. Anyhow, it was an emergency operation. He sorted me out. So all that was sorted out. I was still in hospital, and all male nurses in there, and Royal Army Medical Corps. And a big bottle of Guinness on my table. He said, "This is for you." I said, "Who sent that?" He said, "Nobody sent it." He said, "That's part of the recuperation process. Guinness, good iron in it, you see." So I'd have a bottle of Guinness a night. I was doing all right in there. I'd come out of there then. And then, as I said, we were doing all this bridge surveying and so forth. And, of course, fraternization was going on then. And then we had a club in this village, which we made up to look like a British pub. Like, we used to have all beer, everything, exactly like a British pub. And used to have dances on and all the rest of it. And then at Dusseldorf, we had a club called the 94 Club, which was a serial number of the brigade, 94. And we used to have Dutch dance bands in there, boxing and all the rest of it.
And who organised that?
Army authorities, like.
And so it was quite a good place to be, Dusseldorf.
It wasn't a bad place at all, Dusseldorf.
Then where were you living?
Oh, we were living in a school in this village, Heiligenhaus. Lovely school, bathrooms, everything in there. Real nice place. And of course, there wasn't much going on, like, except for the bridge. We did do a bridge over the River Wupper outside Wuppertal, which was, we were using prisoners of war on it. And it was a concrete bridge. Proper coffer dams and everything, sunk in the river and all the rest of it. I was driving Major Bishop then. I was new CO then, after the war this was. I was driving this Major Bishop. Now he came from, where did he come from? Near Woburn Abbey somewhere he lived. Aylesbury, is it? Up around there? Aylesbury. Mm-hmm. Aylesbury. Okay. Yeah. So I was driving him then, and he used to smoke hand-rolled cigarettes. Balkan cigarettes, they were called, Balkani cigarettes. I used to call him by his Christian name. Then he put me on. He was getting transferred to the Guards Armoured Division, and he wanted me to go with him. And I could put three stripes up straight away if you stop for 6 months. So I had a chat with him. I said, "Well, you're only a temporary commission, aren't you?" He said, "Yes, I'm a lieutenant, substantiated rank." I said, "Well, you're going to drop, aren't you, if you're going to take a permanent commission?" And he said, "I'm probably going to wind you." I said, "You can forget about it. I don't want to know about it." Because my parents were aging then. They were not very well. So I had to come out. I was the only child, obviously. But I would have stopped on. I wanted to stop on. I was going to make a career out of it, you see. Anyhow, that went on there then. And what happened then? The company was disbanded then. All of them were disbanded on the same day. April the 25th, 1945, was disbanded.
Where was that?
Where we were. We got posted.
Where
I got
were you then?
In the same place, but I got posted
in
to
Dusseldorf.
Another. Yeah, in Dusseldorf. Yeah, well, this village. I don't know. We got disbanded then. The company got disbanded. I was posted to the 74th Field Company, which was in Dusseldorf itself. Mm-hmm. And all we done there was twiddle our thumbs till we got demobbed. We still demobbed from our parent unit, 282nd Field Company, and we got demobbed in Krefeld. And we left Krefeld by train, and we went to York, Stansfield Barracks. And in York, we had to hand all the kit in and all the rest of it. And then from there, we went to Ashton-under-Lyme, and that's where we got our civilian clothes and all the necessities that went with it, petrol coupons, your money, the bank book they give you with money. And the last thing we got on the Manchester station, there were two women on Manchester station, they had a bottle of whiskey between them. So there was two of us now, three of us, one bloke from Port Talbot, one from Cardiff, and one myself. and we got this whiskey between us. Now he was in the toilet now. Well, Tom, somebody his name was. Anyway, I can't remember now. He goes in the toilet and comes out dressed up in the civilian clothes, like. And he told us, now, outside Manchester Station, there's all these spibs. They give you £5 for your demob suit. See, what he done, he put all his old clip clunk underwear in the box and sold it for £5, you see, and that was it. Got on a train. Anyhow, we were walking around Manchester now, and we go in those days, you had what you call a British restaurant. You could go in there and get all sorts of things. It was civilian setup. Went in there now, and he had faggots and peas. Now, when we come out, I had my own tunic undone. He had his undone. Two red caps come up to us. Going to put us on a charge for being improperly dressed. I said, we've just been demobbed. No, you're not being demobbed. He said, you're not demobbed. Your leave expires, which is in September, from the time we come out. I was demobbed in May 1946. Your leave expired in September. So that was it. We sorted that out and got on a train, and that was it, the end of that. Mm-hmm. And then, 1951, I was called up on a reserve. I was posted to the 111th Field Regiment, a TA unit, and I went to Weymouth in Dorset. And then pulled up in reserve because you knew all about it, like, more or less, you know. Training TAs and national servicemen. Went there for a fortnight's camp. And I was in charge of the guard there, on one guard on there. But the funny thing about all this, there was an officer there, and we were building a Class 9 raft to carry a modest commercial truck, or Bedford truck. And he gets down on the bridge in sight now, and the officer in charge comes up to me. Now, I'm only a sapper, mind. Comes up to me. I don't know how to do this, he said. I said, well, it's simple enough. I showed him how to do it, put it all together, or the party of us put it together. And, of course, during the war, there was a lot of engineer units, didn't know any bridging at all. They would call E&M units, electrical and mechanical units. That became the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers eventually. But anyhow, he didn't know anything about it, so we put the biz together. Right, we finish this job now, we come back now, we're in camp. They put a guard on the bridge. Now, on the Chesil Beach, you ever been to Chesil Beach at all? Well, it's all pebbles, you know. You imagine bridging on that now. Eh? Bridging on that we were. And the River Fleet flows down there from up somewhere up there into the Portland Harbour. Now, one of the jobs is you've got a permanent folding boat bridge across the river to get to the other side. Now, he put a guard on this bridge now, and one of the jobs of the guard is when the fishing boats come up and down, you've got to take a section of the bridge out, you see, for the fishing boats to go up and down. Anyhow, this joker didn't forget to tie the section up, then he floated off down the river. So there was no bridge to get across the river the following morning for all these men to work. It was hell to play about it. But, you know, that was all right. That lasted a fortnight, as I said. And that was the end of the story.
Right. Going back to when you knew you were going to be demobbed, what were your feelings about, you know, the prospect of the end of...
Well, it was anti-climax, really. Come to a long story. I've done nearly 6.5, 7 years almost. But I could have had a lot of opportunities, really. I was offered a lot of things and I didn't take them, like, you know, like NCOs and things like that. Now, my friend, he was made a Lance Corporal, and it was an orderly room at 2 o'clock this particular afternoon, and I was on orders, and he was on orders. He went in and came out with two stripes. I went in, stripe, I don't want it, I said, thank you very much, don't want it, I'd rather be with the boys. And that was it. And they gave the stripe to another chap, and he went out celebrating the night he had the stripe, come back late, got drunk, hit the guard or something, and he lost his stripe. So anyhow, I didn't take it, but I should have, really.
Was there, I mean, there must have been padres attached.
Oh, yes, you had a padre, yes, oh, yes.
What part did they play?
Well, it was mainly concerned with giving the last rites of wounded soldiers who were going to die and things like that, and arranging their identification, things like that, you know. They had services, what do you call, now and again, when it was necessary, like. Or when they could.
Did you go to them?
One or two I went to. Mm. But a lot of people I've in the church I find hypocritical, you see.
What were the padres?
Well, of course, I tell you an instance. I had a talk with a padre one day, We had a church parade on this particular Sunday morning, and in the afternoon, chaps were on bayonet practice. So I couldn't come to terms with the fact. I said to him, look, you're preaching love, God is love, and all this sort of business, I said. And then this afternoon, I said, the men are learning how to kill somebody. I said, no, how do you put that together? But he said, it's one of those things. No, I said, I don't agree with you. I said, the Germans are praying to their God the same God as what we're praying to, I said. And I've always come to conclusions, you see, that to be a priest or anything like that is vocational. I don't think a lot of them don't really believe in it. I don't believe in the rigmarole of religion as far as archbishops are concerned and all this business. Because, I mean, the basics are Jesus Christ was born in a manger, wasn't he? And he lived a life of real hardship, poverty. And you see all these people and all this rigmarole going on in churches and all of this, but I don't accept that. I don't accept organized religion. I believe in something. Something must have formed something. It just doesn't grow, doesn't it? The chair you're sat in, somebody made it, didn't they? Well, it's the same as the earth, the sky, the moon, and that. That's the way I look at it. I don't believe in hypocritical, like some of them are, you know.
How did people, you know, the ordinary soldiers, how did they see the Padres?
Well, it was a necessity, that's all, I should think. I mean, some Padres could really make a bloke feel, you know, make him feel, confident in himself.
What about, I mean, there was a terrific amount of stress.
Boy, a lot of stress involved, a lot of things.
I mean, did you come across any cases of people, you know, sort of self-wounding?
Yes, a man put his hand in a fan and chop four fingers off. And the other bloke, I told you, jumped in a river. Now, what do I admitted to tell you is this. When we come out of the Ardennes, we went to Liège, which is an American railhead. And he's dropping flying bombs on the Liège every minute. Now, my friend and myself, we were in a pub, billeted in a pub upstairs. When this bomb dropped, it blew all the doors and windows out, right? And he dropped a couple not so far away. I jumped in a 1500 weight truck. I went up the road, and there was a house demolished. In that house was three women. One of them was dead. She was split right down like that from top to bottom, like somebody got a big cleaver and could cut through her. The other two women were badly wounded. I put them in a 1500 weight truck. Two Belgian civilians gave me a hand. I took them to Liège Hospital. Right? And it wasn't a pane of glass or nothing. They had all been blown out. I took these two women there. Now, somebody came and said to me, you would be recommended for a decoration for that. Nobody recommended me. Nobody saw it. Only one person. So that was one instance I took. Another instance was in Liège. We were under a railway tunnel because we were told to get somewhere where it was solid because these things had a 100-yard range of shrapnel, you see, and it could demolish a house if it dropped near it. So we got in a tunnel. Now, I had a pre-war military overcoat, which I had tailored to fit me, right, and all my blankets were under this tunnel. Now, up the road around the corner was a small shop which we used as a place for having food and things. When I come back, the blankets and coat were gone. Whole lot. So I got issued with a chatty old coat then, you know, of course the end of the war coming up, things were, the clothes and materials were inferior to what they were at the beginning of the war. So that was the only things I've admitted out now to you. So the rest of the story, as far as I can understand it, is pretty good, like.
Yes, oh it is, yeah. So, I mean, did you hear of anyone actually sort of killing themselves? Or?
There are only two instances, as far as I know. A lot of blokes are frightened, mind.
Mm.
A lot of blokes, one particular chap we had with us, he'd dig in anyway, no matter where it was. So we cured him of that. Because I went with Ted Lutus on a recce for this castle where we were going in the reserve, you see. And we went in front of our unit, what he called rear party, left behind. And when he arrived, this particular chap, he said, what's the shelling like? I saw it pretty bad up here. I said, you want to get dig in? So we let him dig in this bank now. And he worked damned hard on it, put corrugated sheets on the top of it and all the rest of it. And when he'd finished, he went down and told him, you must be stupid, you were 20 miles beyond the front line. he cured him of that, he didn't do any digging after that. We didn't have time to do any digging, we were moving that fast.
Yeah. So, I mean, What did you think of the other Allied troops? I mean, you've mentioned the Americans and the Canadians. What was the general opinion? What did you think?
This is going to be controversial, really, isn't it?
I don't mind that.
I don't personally think the Americans, the Germans, to quote the Germans, they thought Americans were soft compared to the British. They were loudmouthed to a large degree. You see, where British soldiers are biased against the Americans is the fact they had plenty of money in this country. Flash uniforms, bags of talk, rows of medals on their chest, which were not concerned with action at all. Rows of medals on their chest. And women got sort of, they fell from the big way. I can tell you quite of instance, a lot of girls in this town were caught in British soldiers, and when they came back, they were off with the Americans, like, that sort of thing. I give you an instance myself. I was on leave, and I was up in the station up here, and I went over the bridge, and I was engaged then. She stopped this side of the road whilst I went over the bridge, and when I come back, was an American trying to walk her off. I said, on your bike, told him straight, on your bike, move. And he still persisted, and in the end, I was going to sort him out, but he understood what I meant and what I was saying, and he went. That sort of thing, persuasive, you see.
What about the Canadians?
Oh, they were French Canadians were mad. They were in Sussex, they were, but they were mad. They were good fighters, mind. Good fighters, but the Americans, I don't know. Of course, the Ardennes, as far as the British effort, was covered up. There's no doubt about it, it was covered up. Very little was said about it, about the effort we put in down there.
Why do you think that was?
Political. Political, definitely political. The Americans didn't like Eisenhower. The Americans didn't like Montgomery. No way. They weren't going to take orders, Patton especially. And if Montgomery took command of two armies during the Battle of the Ardennes, two American armies. And Eisenhower, as a general, what experience did Eisenhower have prior to the D-Day landings and all that? You see? They tended to be took too many men into a small action. That's why they lost so many.
What about the RAMC?
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah. No doubt about it. Especially stretcher bearers. Fantastic.
That's the end of Reel 6.